Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 15th of October, these are our main stories. President Trump renews his threat to destroy Turkey's economy as criticism mounts over his decision to withdraw U.S. troops from northern Syria, opening the way for the Turkish attack on the Kurds. Violent clashes erupt in Spain as Catalan separatist leaders get lengthy jail sentences. And the winner of the prestigious Booker Prize for Literature is revealed. Also in this podcast...
Привет, это Skybot F850.
It's in the middle of an abort right now.
The trouble with robots in Russia. Let's begin in the U.S., where President Trump has announced plans to issue an executive order imposing sanctions on Turkey in response to its attacks on the Syrian Kurds. This follows his decision a week ago to remove U.S. troops from northern Syria, a move analysts described as giving the green light for the Turkish offensive. Mr. Trump now says he will increase tariffs on Turkish steel and halt negotiations on a trade deal. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said he won't back down in his campaign against the Kurds, no matter what anyone says. I asked our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue why President Trump had announced the planned sanctions now.
I think there are a couple of factors at play here. One is clearly the domestic pressure that there has been on him from some of his key allies, don't forget, people who are not critical about him pretty much ever, like Lindsey Graham in the Senate and others on the right, like Mitch McConnell as well, the leader of the Senate. These people have come out and been very, very forceful in their criticism, and I think the president has felt that. And I think the other element of pressure is, in a sense, what's unfolding on the ground. So for the president, you know, the idea of having established or claimed this idea of having destroyed ISIS, destroyed the caliphate, etc., to suddenly see these stories emerging about prisoners escaping and about the SDF and the Kurds not guarding these prisons anymore and potential ISIS fighters out again, that is very tricky. So I think those factors are putting a lot of pressure on the president. And of course, it's a very fluid situation on the ground. He has no control because he's specifically withdrawn US troops from there. So this is a way of putting maximum pressure, I think, on Turkey, not only to be restrained, but also then to sort of ensure that all these other things don't happen, like the breakouts from prison camps and that kind of thing.
And he's also said there are U.S. troops remaining in the region, perhaps hinting that, you know, they could be activated if need be.
This is a campaign promise, and, you know, the White House will repeat this ad nauseam. The president promised to bring troops home, and this is what he's doing. Well, what he's actually doing in this particular case is moving these 1,000 or so troops, including the one that's 50, bunch of 50 around the border posts and the 1,000 that were a little bit further south. He's moving them, we understand, bar a small handful, out of northern Syria into Iraq, just across the border. They're not really coming home in that sense at all. And it's worth bearing in mind, and these are not my guesses, these are official figures from Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense. Since May, there are now 17,000 more US troops and personnel in that region, in the whole kind of Central Command region, than there were, 6 months ago.
Gary O'Donoghue. Meanwhile, on the ground in Syria... Sounds of jubilation in the north as Syrian government troops move into the vacuum left behind by the American forces. Our correspondent Martin Patience is on the Turkish side of the border. What do we know about how the Syrian troops have been received?
Well, it's very difficult to know. All we have is Syrian state media to go on, and it's no surprise that they're showing kind of celebrations of Syrian government forces entering territory that they haven't been in for several years. There's no doubt, though, for the Syrian government, they will regard this as a major victory. A week ago, Kurdish forces were supported by America. Now they've reached an agreement with the Syrian government, and it's moved in to at least two towns in the northeast of the country, bringing back territory under its control.
And how's Turkey reacting to all of this?
Well, what's interesting is Turkey is continuing its offensive. President Erdogan says he won't back down. I'm just across from the Syrian town of Ras Alain, and we've seen three airstrikes from Turkey a short while ago, so that goes on. I think what's significant is the Syrian government troops have moved into towns which are not part of the Turkish offensive. The danger will come when there's kind of contested towns, and you could have a situation where pro-Turkish forces are attacking the Syrian government, which, let's not forget, is backed by Russia and Iran. That's one of the big dangers, that this border area could become a flashpoint for a kind of potentially broader conflict. That is the worry.
But presumably that's something all sides, these big powers involved, especially Turkey and Russia and Iran, would like to avoid.
Absolutely. But what you can't avoid is a miscalculation on the battlefield. What we're seeing in Syria is an utterly chaotic situation. The American withdrawal from the northeast of the country has created a vacuum, and all the powers are rushing to fill that vacuum at the moment. As for the Kurds, they've been completely marginalised. They are no longer a player because they no longer have the backing of America.
It's hard to take in just how much things have changed in a few days, in a matter of days, basically. How much of a turning point is this for Syria?
I think from the Syrian government's point of view, it will view it incredibly favourably, because what it will hope to do in the coming days and weeks is bring a large chunk of territory again under its control. Some might say this makes the end game of the conflict a bit easier. Why is that? Well, because you've got fewer players. America and the Kurds are now out of the equation.
Martin, patience. In a surprise twist, this year's Booker Prize has been split between two of the six shortlisted books. The joint winners of the prestigious Literary Award for Fiction were announced at the Guildhall in central London.
The two winners of the 2019 Booker Prize for Fiction are Margaret Atwood for The Testaments and Bernardine Evaristo for Girl, Woman, Other.
Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd has more.
The Booker Prize has been going since 1969. This is without doubt one of the most extraordinary results. It used to be permissible to split the award, and that happened twice in 1974 and again in 1992 when Michael Ondaatje won for The English Patient. After that, the rules changed, and it's explicitly stated in the regulations there can only be a single winner. But the judges this time decided simply to flout that rule. So the 2019 prize has been split between Margaret Atwood for The Testaments, her follow-up to The Handmaid's Tale, so recently a big hit on the small screen, and Bernardine Evaristo for Girl, Woman, Other. She's a British-Nigerian author who often explores the lives of the African diaspora in the UK. The chair of the judges, Peter Florence, said he and his four colleagues had not wanted to throw out either of these two books. Some people will, of course, say, well, sorry, that's exactly what prize juries have to do. Perhaps more will come out over the next day or so about why the judges rebelled against the rules. Both books are political in their own way and in part about how we live together in a divided world. So was this a statement, perhaps, by the judges suggesting there are few absolutes and that we should learn to tolerate a range of opinions around us?
Vincent Dowd. Tunisia was the cradle of the Arab Spring, that wave of anti-government protests, uprisings and armed rebellions that swept across North Africa and the Middle East from the end of 2010. It's also turned out to be the only relative success story, which is not to say the country has not been afflicted by a stagnant economy, corruption, joblessness and poor public services. But Tunisia has now managed to hold its second direct presidential election since the 2011 revolution. And a conservative academic and political outsider, Kais Saied, has emerged as the landslide winner after campaigning on what he called the values of the Arab Spring and promising to build a new Tunisia. So how effective is he likely to be? Political activist Rautha Ben-Othman is professor of linguistics at Tunis University, knows Mr. Said personally, and has been telling my colleague Julian Marshall more about him.
Now, the guy is really clean and honest. He's not corrupt at all. And they need this tone of hope, and they trust that he's going to make a difference in the future.
But with all due respect, that's the kind of thing that all politicians say, isn't it? That they're going to fight corruption, they're going to make a difference.
Yeah, but they need to fight the people who believe that they will. For the last 5 years in Tunisia, since the last 2014 elections, with the winning of the old regime figures, people started thinking that corruption is normal and they tend to accept it. They have never really meant that they are fighting corruption. So even if they say it, nobody believes them.
You say that Kais Saied has been very popular amongst young people, and that
yes,
despite the fact that he is described as a social conservative.
He is conservative, but our young generation is more conservative than our old generation. Conservatism is somehow the fashion right now all over the world. They trust him, they identify with him, and especially they believe him. More than 80% of his voters are university graduates.
That's social conservatism amongst mm-hmm. young people in Tunisia. Extends to the kinds of remarks that Kais Saied has made about homosexuality. He's very disparaging about that, isn't he?
Many people share his own position. Homosexuality is not hot on the agenda at all for these young unemployed people. They would like to see more jobs. They would like to see more hope. They would like to see better politics. So this is a very minor issue for them, if ever they think about it. They have other fish to fry.
So what's in the new president's in tray? What are the issues that he's got to tackle apart from corruption?
He actually promised his voters what he calls a legislative revolution. He would like to make many laws in order to reform, especially politics. I mean, I think Tunisians, they have really witnessed what really means to be politically corrupt. So for them, not only they trust somebody who is not corrupt, but also he promised them a number of laws that are hopefully going to clean the politics.
Rautha Ben-Othman, professor of linguistics at Tunis University. Still to come in the podcast.
This was impressive stuff. Lavish gusts of filth in person and on social media.
From a simple damn to the F-bomb when it comes to swearing, is it ever okay at work? Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of Barcelona after a group of high-profile Catalan separatists were handed lengthy jail sentences for their part in a failed independence bid in 2017. 9 separatist leaders were given prison terms of between 9 and 13 years. Another 3 received fines. The former vice president of Catalonia, Oriol Junqueras, who received the longest sentence, said they'd been jailed for their political ideals, but that was denied by the Spanish prime minister. Later, riot police clashed with protesters, disrupting flights at Barcelona airport. This report from our correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
This is Barcelona Airport Terminal 1, and there are thousands of protesters here. Impossible to tell how many because they're filling the road up to the airport, the access ramp to the terminal, and also the area in front of the car park. All facing off, standing in front of them are riot police in helmets and shields. The protesters have been here all afternoon disrupting flights because they want to show their anger at the sentences handed down to Catalonia's pro-independence leaders today, up to 13 years each for sedition. One of those out on the streets was Olga, a professor at Barcelona University.
It really is a disgrace. It's not a sentence, it's a vengeance what we're receiving here. And actually, it doesn't matter whether you're independentist or you're not, whether you believe that another political project is possible. It's a question of democracy.
The call to shut down the airport had gone out early in the day, just after the verdicts were announced. The protesters blocked off roads from 5 or 6 kilometres away. I'm now outside the airport on the slip roads and coming to it. Hundreds of people still marching towards the building and passengers too, dragging their luggage to and from the site. The pro-independence leaders had been sentenced to up to 13 years in prison for sedition. They escaped the harsher sentences of up to 25 years for the crime of rebellion. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez told the nation today that nobody was above the law, and he said the leaders had not been punished for their ideas, but rather for law-breaking.
Today's decision confirms the defeat of a movement that failed to gain internal support and international recognition. Following the Supreme Court decision, we need to turn the page and open a new chapter based on peaceful coexistence in Catalonia through dialogue within the boundaries of the law and the Spanish Constitution.
Catalonia's independence leaders have been in jail for the past 2 years, since the unauthorised referendum they held in the region and then the failed bid for independence, which was rapidly quashed by the central government. The president of Catalonia at the time, Carles Puigdemont, fled Spain for Belgium, where he's been living in exile. Today, he called the prison sentences outrageous.
It is no crime, no offence, to propose to citizens that they freely decide their own future. Placing ballot boxes will never be a crime. Posting voting slips in these boxes to express the will of every citizen is the solution, not the problem.
Mr. Puigdemont called on people in Catalonia, he said, to express their views in national elections due next month. Spain's government, meanwhile, has reactivated a European arrest warrant for him. And the Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, called for people to give up what he called extremism.
Damian Grammaticus in Barcelona. Russia likes to boast of its robots, but seems to have a troubled relationship with them. There was disappointment recently when its robot, Fyodor, failed to get to the International Space Station. There have also been the odd PR mishaps where what's been touted as robotic advances have turned out to be anything but. Despite all that, some say there are still grounds for optimism for the Russian robotics industry, as Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
Привет, это Skybot F-850.
The Russian robot Fyodor aboard a Soyuz 14 spacecraft in August. A short while after, amid much media fanfare in Russia and praise for the Russian space agency Roscosmos, he was reporting on its progress. 2 minutes into the flight, he announced that things were going to plan and the first stage rocket has separated from his spacecraft hurtling towards the International Space Station. But then this happened.
Station Houston on 2, Soyuz is aborting.
Hey, Alexander. Go ahead. This is Vladimir. It's in the middle of an abort right now.
Mission Control in Houston broke the news that Fyodor's mission to dock with the International Space Station had to be aborted because of a technical problem. To be fair to Fyodor, he was not to blame. Even though state media touted him as a major breakthrough, and some incorrectly suggested that he was piloting the spacecraft, he did little but talk. Fyodor's designer, Yevgeny Dudorov, told me why.
The robot was originally created for working on Earth, and because it is not integrated into the spacecraft or the International Space Station at all, we introduced a number of restrictions. As far as artificial intelligence is concerned, only speech interaction is left. Cosmonauts can ask him questions and the robot will answer them. Questions like, how are you? What are you doing here?
Before his spaceflight, state TV showed him driving a car, firing guns and doing push-ups. But skeptics do have grounds for skepticism when the Russian media reports another breakthrough in robot technology. There have been some exaggerated claims. This was Boris, a robot who made his appearance last year on state TV and announced that he'd like to start composing music. He also danced. The problem was, Boris was later discovered to be a man in costume. Away from the dramatic headlines, though, it's a different story.
Russia is very good in robotics research, and the robot they just have sent to space is part of this research work.
Dr. Susanna Bieler is the General Secretary of the International Federation of Robotics. She says Russia has a lot to be positive about. What it does have to do is work on selling its technology.
If you look at the robot market, Russia is not yet a big player. It's a customer of robots. If you compare that on a global scale, that's number 27. They are not so progressed when it comes to commercializing their research.
It's a problem recognized by Lisa Konyakhovska, a Russian who's on the board of the Federation. She says robotics experts need to start showing Russians a less glamorous, but perhaps a more practical side of robots.
Sometimes people think about robots like some robots that show in the movies and something like that. But we need to show people what is a real opportunity to use robot in life and business process and how robots can help to improve quality of business process and quality of people's life.
The trip into space may not have showered further the robot in glory, but perhaps the real challenge for the Russian media is to report on the gradual steps being taken by Russia so that Russian companies can compete with foreign robotic rivals.
Vitaly Shevchenko of BBC Monitoring reporting. What happens when your computer crashes at work, taking the document you've worked on for hours with it? Or you lose one of your biggest clients or someone steals your lunch from the fridge? Well, if you're anything like me, you might swear out loud, not giving much thought to the colleagues around you. Oh, I would never. In fact, swearing for many of us has become quite commonplace, but do we all need to be a bit more careful of using swear words at work, or does it not matter? Pelita Clark of the Financial Times has been finding out.
Does it matter if you swear a bit at work? What about the odd crass vulgarity? These questions have been on my mind ever since a friend told me, in vibrant detail, how exuberantly a senior executive in her office swore. I grew up on an Australian sheep farm and once worked on a fishing boat, but this was impressive stuff. Lavish gusts of filth, in person and on social media. It had been the subject of much gossip in my friend's office, but it hadn't caused any obvious bother for the executive who had been repeatedly promoted. Researchers say people who swear can seem more honest, credible and persuasive, though there is, of course, swearing and swearing. One US study that found profanity could be persuasive arrived at the conclusion after testing people's reaction to damn, a word so mild it barely qualifies as an obscenity in many offices. Context also matters, of course. A four-letter word howl at a jammed printer is more acceptable than one thrown at a boss. And when workers are asked if they approve of bad language in the office, they invariably say they do not. But fruity language need not be an obstacle to career success, which is something that a lot of smart business leaders have long understood. JP Morgan Chase's boss, Jamie Dimon, is the longest-serving bank chief executive on Wall Street and a bracingly blunt speaker in a sea of corporate timidity. He openly derides critics he has, let's say, cheesed off, and people he has, as it were, scared witless. As it happens, finance is only the second worst sector for swearing. It's slightly worse in the healthcare industry, according to the data. But does location matter? The other day, I did a cursory trawl through earnings call transcripts of S&P 500 and FTSE 100 companies since 2007 that revealed a trove of R-rated blather. I'd expected to find a lot more in the UK, where it's been claimed that the average Brit swears 14 times a day, but I was wrong. A more extensive analysis of conference call transcripts by CNBC journalists in the United States in 2016 found the incidence of corporate profanity seemed to be on the rise that year compared with the previous 2 years. This chimes with the findings of academics, who it turns out spent an astonishing amount of time studying swearing. Hundreds of papers have been written on the topic since 1900, according to two experts who said in 2012 that there wasn't much evidence the culture was deteriorating when it came to profanity. More recent US research suggests swearing might be on the rise at work, though, especially among millennials. Either way, one should remember that no matter how old you are, where you live or where you work, there are some places where swearing is not only frowned upon but illegal in public places. The rapper 50 Cent discovered this a few years ago when he was fined for cursing on stage in the Caribbean island of St. Kitts.
That was journalist Pilita Clark reflecting on swearing at work. A filthy habit. On Sunday night, the world ended. No, luckily it wasn't our world, but the online gaming world of Fortnite. It's one of the biggest online computer games and has amassed 250 million players since its launch in 2017. But now fans have been left unable to play after its entire map disappeared into a virtual black hole. It's part of a worldwide event to mark the end of the game's 10th season. The newsroom's Siobhan Leahy has more.
What is going on?
That was it. The moment one of the 6 million Fortnite fans watched an asteroid obliterate the game into nothingness. Now, if you don't know, Fortnite is a hugely popular and notoriously addictive online shooter game. About 100 people are pitted against each other on a small island in a fight to the death until one person is left standing. It's free to use, but it generates hundreds of millions of dollars a year for its owners. And in July, Fortnite held its own World Cup, where players competed for $30 million prize money. The game works in seasons, or chapters, the latest launched in August until its dramatic end on Sunday, which fans had been anticipating. Now, if you venture online to play the game, this is currently what you'll get. Not much. It's simply running a live stream of a black hole. And as I'm recording this, there are more than 60,000 people watching and waiting for something to happen. So how have the diehard Fortnite fans reacted?
Excuse me? What?
Some clearly mourning the loss of Fortnite forever. But it's likely this move is just hype for the launch of the 11th season. Regardless, taking one of the world's biggest games offline is a bold decision by its owners, but one that parents of teenagers might be glad of, for a few days at least.
No doubt they will. Siobhan Leahy. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.